Welcome to the Archive Room podcast, stories of Manx life in years gone by, told by the people who were there. Manx Radio. Fasta Mai, Judith Leigh here, once again opening the door to the Archive Room, Manx Radio's treasure chest of stories of island life from years gone by, told by the people who were there. So, come on in, and let me take you for another gentle stroll down Manx Memory Lane. In the Archive Room tonight, I'm stopping at the shelf labelled Cinema, and I'm spoilt for choice because there are so many good stories here. But before we go any further, we've a mystery to solve. At the end of last week's programme, I asked if you could name this man and his father.
Eventually, I would wander up onto Douglas Head, onto the fairground up there, and of course the people up there knew me, and they knew me dad, and he could play anything at all. He was a wonderful musician.
Well, award yourself 10 points if you said that's the voice of Mike Ventry, and a further 10 bonus points if you said he's talking about his father, the musician Johnny Ventro. But one family with two surnames? There has to be a story there, and David Collister has it.
I'd like to talk to you just a little while about your father, who was quite famous in the Isle of Man, really, wasn't he?
He was, in fact, yeah. Although, you know, my name is Mike Ventry. Actually, my father went under the name of Ventro, because he used to be on the stage as a violinist many, many years ago. And, you know, these stage people, they change their names. He changed his name from Ventry to Ventro for stage purposes only.
Yes.
But the name actually is Ventry.
Now, your father wasn't Tony Ventro.
No, Tony was my uncle, my father's brother. My father was Johnny, a very well-known man on the Isle of Man. He had bands, and the bands used to play on the ferry boats going across to Douglas Head. And he was a very popular man, there's no doubt about that, and a wonderful musician.
Did you go on the ferry boats?
Yes, I did, yes. Before the war, I was a young boy. I used to spend a lot of time down there. I loved them. And I loved the music. I used to just go back and forward and back and forward. And then eventually I would wander up onto Douglas Head, onto the fairground up there. And of course, the people up there knew me, and they would allow me to throw the mops at the tin cans, etc., yeah, without paying, because they knew me dad and they knew who I was. Mm. And
what sort of music would he play then? Would it be like the popular tunes of the time?
Yes, all the popular tunes of the time. He was a song plugger, basically. And he could play anything at all. He was a wonderful musician. Lawrence Wright, etc., you know, all the people in town, the music people, used to come to my father with new pieces of music, and they would say, Johnny, will you play this for us?
Yeah.
And he would plug it, of course, for a few bob. That's how he earned his living. And
When he worked on the ferries then, how was he paid? Was he paid officially by the ferry owners, or did he have to rely on the tips from the passengers?
Basically, it was the tips from the passengers. The ferry used to go across the headland, and while they were going over, the band used to play, and someone used to go around with a collection box.
Mm.
And that is, in fact, just the money that was used to pay the band and my father. That's all. There was no salary in those days. It was just, as you say, tips.
So he wasn't going to be earning a huge amount of money then, was he?
He did all right. We managed to live, you know, all year on the money that he earned there. But everyone thought he was a millionaire, you know, because he would wander home at night on the buses with big bags of money, and all, it was all pennies and farthings and halfpennies. I used to sit down and help him to count them, and it was great fun. And we used to have a big round table, and he used to pour all the money out onto the table. Anything that fell on the floor was mine. And it was great fun, you know. And
he
would nudge the table from time to time. And if you've seen a threepenny bit or something hanging close by, and that used to go in my money box.
Right. Can you remember how many passengers the ferries would carry, roughly?
Oh, they would hold up to anything about 60 or 80 people, I would think. Well, the ferry boats used to go back and forward. One would come from Douglas Head to Douglas, and the other would go from the Victoria Pier over to Douglas Head.
Yeah.
And they would cross in the middle.
7 days a week?
7 days a week throughout the summer, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yes, wet or fine, ferries would run. But, you know, a lot of local people in those days who didn't have an awful lot of money for entertainment used to just simply go down onto the Victoria Pier and stand there and listen to the music being played on the ferry boats.
Oh, yes.
And it was beautiful.
Well, that'd be nice, wouldn't it?
Oh, it was lovely. Yeah. It was just like going to a band concert. And it was free, of course.
Your father sounds like a sort of generous man, really.
He was a lovely man. He was a thorough gentleman. I know, okay, he was my dad, and most people say that about their dads, but, you know, I had so much fun with him. He was a likeable character. He taught me to ride a bike and roller skate, and he taught me to swim. He did all the things a dad should do, you know.
He didn't teach you to play the violin, though.
No, he didn't. He got me playing like the piano for a little while, but I gave that up. I regret that now, of course. I would love to have been able to play an instrument. But, you know, football and, you know, young ladies sort of got in the way, and we tended not to bother.
Yeah. Now, your father was really from Italian extraction, wasn't he?
Yes, my grandfather came over to England when he was 3 years of age. And my father was, in fact, born in Liverpool. So he's a Liverpoolian. And my mum was born in Liverpool also. And they came over here. It was great because, you know, we used to do so many things together. I used to go swimming with my father. I used to play chess with him. I used to play snooker with him. We used to go for walks together. He would come into my bedroom at midnight when we lived in Palace Road. We had a guest house there. And he would come into my bedroom sometimes at midnight when I was fast asleep, and he would shake me and say, "Come on, let's go for a swim down on the promenade." And the two of us would run down Palace Road, dive into the water, and then come back up again, and then we'd sit down and we'd have an enormous big feed.
After midnight.
It was a wonderful time. He was a wonderful dad. We got on so well.
Right.
He was really good.
What about Uncle Tony then, the singer?
Well, Tony came over to the island and he went for an audition with the Joe Loss Orchestra. Tony was a tenor. And they took him on, and he was in fact the tenor for the Joe Loss Orchestra for quite a number of years. And of course he used to sing in the Villa Marina. The first night he came on, they just announced him as Tony. They didn't give another name, they just said, "We have a new tenor, his name is Tony." And he came on and he sang very nicely indeed. And after the show, he was seen in the Villa Marina. I think we were having a cup of coffee, him and I. And of course, he looked very much like my father.
Yeah.
Well, the newspapers had it the following day that it was Tony Ventro.
Yeah.
So he then went under the name of Ventro.
Mm.
That's how the name actually stuck in the island.
At the start of the programme, I said I'd be pausing in the archive room at the shelf marked cinema. So now it's time to hear a collection of wonderful stories from the days when the island's many cinemas were packed to suffocation. Tonight we'll hear from cinema goers, from cinema managers, and from Fred Moore, who looks back to 1946 on the challenges, but mostly the comedy, of working with the crew on the making of I See a Dark Stranger, a World War II spy drama filmed on the island starring Deborah Carr and Trevor Howard. And to this day, it's still described by film buffs as suspenseful as Hitchcock, but with a touch of humour and romance. But first, let's eavesdrop on a conversation between David Collister and Mr. Charles Kelly. Born in 1907, he's taking us back to cinema going around the time of the First World War.
This was 1915-16. There was the Strand, the Picture House, the Pier Pavilion. I think those were the three picture houses. Pier Pavilion, you could get in a Saturday afternoon matinee for a penny or an empty jam jar. The jam jar was all important.
Where do you get the jam jars from? Your mother, I suppose?
Oh, yes. Mother or scrounge them from a neighbour if you could have scrounged them anywhere. It was only the Pier Pavilion, I think, you could do it in.
Aye.
You couldn't do it in the Strand or the Picture House. Rush and Abbey were making jam at that time, marmalade in particular.
So the jars were in short supply?
I can remember Quinny's low-loaded carts going along the North Quay with boxes of oranges on. And we kids were after them, jumping on the back and see if they pinch one out. And if you got one, they were as bitter as gall.
So what was it, a Saturday afternoon thing, the pictures?
Saturday afternoon pictures, yes. but they had ran serials.
Silent films.
Oh yes, silent films. Mr. Jordan, he kept the jewelry shop alongside the Strand.
Mm-hmm.
He was the manager.
Was he?
Yes.
Yeah.
They used to have songs. To open up, they always had a song. And there was one, The Man in the Laughing Mask. And there was a song. When the man with the laughing mask comes around your way, don't be afraid, don't get dismayed, just take his hand and say, how do, Mr. Bogey Boo. When the man with the laughing mask comes round your way, he'll bring good luck to you. Don't get scared of his ugly face, there's no harm when he's round the place, for he's only the movie Boogie Boogie Boo. Mr. Jordan would be up in front of the screen conducting us kids, and we'd be yelling away at the tops of our voices. Then when it would come on the screen, we'd be shouting, look out behind you! Myself included, I suppose. When the villain would be coming on the screen, you know.
Yeah.
And the pianist would be playing away like Billy O.
Yes.
Yes. And then at night time, between the two houses every night, one 6:30, the other was at 8:00. But the roof would slide open to ventilate the cinema.
Did it?
Yeah, and you could feel the hot air going up and the cold air coming in.
Yes.
Oh, lovely.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah.
You could see the smoke going out into the night sky.
The films didn't have film stars in those days, did they?
Oh, yes. Bill Cody, Tom Mix. There was another one, Lewis Stone. He was an English actor.
Yes.
Lewis Stone. Pearl White.
Oh, yes.
Do you remember her?
Now, Pearl White was getting tied to the railway tracks on the train.
Yes, or on the sawmill. Circular saw would be coming up to her. The kids would be shouting.
You must have seen a lot of Charlie Chaplin's in your time.
Oh, yes, I saw Charlie Chaplin's bending the lamppost over and gas on the villain.
Wonderful stuff, isn't it, really?
Yes, it is.
Happy days, were they?
Oh, happy days. Yes. Happy days.
Now, what about the west of the island? Was there ever a cinema in Peel? Eddie Lees has the answer.
You know, we had a cinema in Peel, 1920s. Saturday afternoon, pay a penny and go down to the hut which stood where Dickie Crane now has his car showroom. And this was run by... Did you ever hear of Howard Hughes?
Oh, yes. What, the American Howard Hughes?
No. This was the Peel Howard Hughes.
No.
He wasn't a Peel man, but he and his wife, they were a bit eccentric. They walked around the streets of Peel all dressed up as if they were taking part in a film, you know.
Yes.
And I believe that they had been on the stage at one time. But Howard Hughes, he used to have a little projector in his shed out there at the back. He used to have these old cowboy films, black and white, you know.
Mm.
Absolutely marvellous it was. And also, he used to have Pierrots in the summer for the visitors.
Where would they be?
On the sand, just in front of the Marine Hotel there.
Yeah.
In fact, we got a photograph down in the museum off the stage there, everything, chairs and everything out in the front.
Yeah.
As popular as could be, you know. He was absolutely marvellous, was Howard Hughes, and he ran this little picture place.
And so, from cinema goers, let's hear now from cinema managers. Here's David again, in the company of two cinema managers employed by the Palace Company. They're Charles Draper and Laurie Kissack.
Well, let me begin with you, Charles, and ask you when you got into this cinema management with the Palace Company, because you'd had experience in the world of films before you managed cinemas here, didn't you?
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, when I left school, I joined the Western Electric Company, who were a company manufacturing and installing sound equipment in studios as well as projectors in cinemas. And after I'd learnt all about wiring and things like that. I was appointed as assistant to their resident engineer installing sound equipment in Denham Studios.
Really? Yeah.
And we used to work on the first films being shot using mostly portable equipment because the final equipment hadn't then been installed. And it was quite interesting for a young man to meet all these film stars and chat to them like any other member of the staff.
So you came to the Isle of Man to work here at some stage, and I remember seeing you in the Strand Cinema most of all, I think.
Yes, that's right. I was here during the war for two and a half years at Valkyrie. And when I returned to the Western Electric Company after the war, I couldn't find anywhere to live adjacent to film studios. So I decided to come back to the island. I'd made lots of friends here. And I was appointed as manager of the Strand Cinema when I arrived. May 1946. I used to work as manager of the Strand Cinema during the summer season, and then in the winter we all moved around because the bigger buildings used to be closed, such as the Royalty and the Crescent cinemas were closed, and I then went doing the holiday reliefs at all the cinemas that the Palace Company possessed.
You've been in all of them, in
fact? Yes. Strand Cinema, Port Erin, the Pavilion at Peel, and the Avenue Onken, and all the Douglas cinemas.
Yes. Were you a film fan yourself then?
Not really. I used to enjoy some films. Very rarely did I ever see a film right through. But on occasions, I used to pick out odd bits of the film that I enjoyed, such as the No Limit film, for instance. The funniest bits. I used to love going into the hall to hear the shrieks of laughter.
Yeah. Well, Laurie Kizik, I remember seeing you at the Royalty. Were you primarily a cinema manager or not?
No. I was only doing relief work then. I started with the company in 1935. And I was in the office, and in the summertime I worked at the Palace as a money taker or taking tickets. And when I came back after the war, I was assistant manager at the Palace with George Vereker. I was assistant from 46 up to 1957 and manager from 58 up to 65. I was more or less in live entertainment all the time.
I've seen both of you fellas standing out there in your monkey suits many a time. And you had to wear these dinner suits then, did you? I mean, law in the Palace Company, was it?
Yeah. Yes.
Well, I did one night at the Regal Cinema without socks on. It was pointed out to me by one of the usherettes in the circle.
Well, how did you manage the queues? Because there must have been colossal queues in the 40s and 50s.
Oh, yes. From the Strand Cinema point of view, we weren't allowed to queue in Strand Street because otherwise it prevented shoppers from looking into the shop windows. So we used to have to queue in Howard Street opposite, and the doorman used to stand over there, and I used to send the people across to him, and they queued down Howard Street and then along the promenade and on some occasions round the next street where the butcher's is on the corner of Strand Street. I could see the end of the queue forming at the end of Strand Street.
What, queuing even in wet weather as well?
Yes, I remember one night relief. It was a Saturday night. It was pouring rain. The first house was full, but at the Strand you could push everybody out through into Market Street, through the back, you see.
Yes.
So I filled two waiting rooms with maybe 100 people in each.
Yeah.
And I decided to bring some people in on the staircase, standing two together, you see. And that was about 7:45, with the show finishing at 8:00. And everybody was just hinky-dory. And the building inspector walked in, and he had me.
Well, he'd be like the fire officer today.
So I was reported.
You reported, were you? Yes. Yeah. On the carpet next day, was it?
Yeah. But the people who I let in out of the rain were very pleased that I'd done so.
Yes. Well, you must have met some of the film stars over the years. I know, Charles, that Anna Neagle came to the island several times.
Yes.
She came for film premieres sometimes, didn't
yes,
she?
Yes, that's right. It was due to Billy Hughes, the cinema manager, you know, in charge of all the cinema side. He was friendly with Herbert Wilcox, who was Anna Neagle's husband, and produced the films. And it was due to their friendship that they used to show their films first as a world premiere in the Isle of Man.
Being a cinema manager, though, it wasn't really a glamorous job, was it, I'm sure?
Not really, no. We used to go through all the seats after the show. The object of it, really, was to see that there were no cigarette butts burning there. The operator used to do the circle and I used to do the ground floor.
Yeah.
And as well as looking for the cigarette butts, we also looked for lost property. And on one occasion, I remember seeing what looked like a bag of sweets, and I picked this up and looked in it, and there was a piece of toffee with a full set of noshers stuck in it, and they were never claimed.
Oh, dear, dear, dear.
And finally, being involved in film production may sound quite exciting, even glamorous, rubbing shoulders with the stars and working with professionals. But as Fred Moore discovered back in 1946, the reality could be quite different. He got the chance to work on the making of I See a Dark Stranger, a World War II spy film starring Deborah Carr.
An Isle of Man signpost outside a French town. That's odd. But we started this tale at the wrong moment. It really began much earlier. It's the story of a very strange little character named Bridie Quilty.
The story was actually set in Ireland, in a fictional town of Ballygarry. But the filming was done in various locations all around the Isle of Man. Here, Fred describes how he first got involved.
They got a hold of my employer to see if they could hire the van because the camera was on a big stand on rubber tyres.
Yes.
So they engaged the van for the fortnight and I was the driver sent to do this work.
Moving their gear around.
Yes. And the headquarters was in the electric tram sheds at Derby Castle. Well, we were in several locations. I remember one, it was rather amusing. You know the Orisdale Road near the blackboards?
Mm-hmm.
We stopped there one morning, and I don't know what the reason was or what they were going to do. But the first thing they ever done when we got to a location was send somebody off for tea and cakes. And they sent a 5-ton lorry that day off to Castletown to get tea and cakes. Well, while we were there, this is rather amusing bit. There was a man came along the road with a cow on a rope. And the director said to me, what's that man bringing a cow along the road on the rope for? I said, he's going up to that farm to see Mr. Cow. And that was Orisdale Farm.
Yes.
Well, the farmhouse is one side of the road, the yard was the other. They trotted off up and I meet with them behind the man with the cow. And it was the daughter of the farm that came out to let the bull out. And there was Arfalit in the gateway of the yard with their cameras taking pictures. But why we were ever at that location, we stood there for a couple of hours and then away. Well, the next place I was with them, we went down the Sound Road. We didn't go as far as the Sound. About halfway down, we opened the gate, turned left, and we didn't cross the field, and they were taking pictures in on the rocks over there. And then another day, we were at the Niavel. And what was to happen, Deborah was to come in a fishing boat to the Niavel. And she was to be put on a rowing boat and rowed in. And while this was happening, in the little cafe on the corner at the bottom of the Niavel there, and Mrs. Clegg had it, they lived in the thatched cottage. It was all laid out for our lunch. And just as we were starting the lunch, the director shouted, break, and when they break, you break, everybody moves. And what had happened was, it was too stormy for Deborah to be rowed ashore, so we had to go back to Peel. Left the lunch, Fenella Beach. We went all into Fenella Beach and up on the cliff there, and she was to tip her grandfather over the cliff. It was a dummy, of course, in a wheelchair.
Actually, she didn't do that job. The assistant director put her Mac on, rolled his trousers up, put her scarf over his head.
Yeah.
And he'd a rope around his waist in case he happened to go over as well. And I had the other end of the rope hanging on in case he went over. At Union Mills, I don't know whose pony and trap they had, but they came down through the village in the pony and trap. They stopped at the top of the steps. Those days it was steps going down to the station. They made a slipway after. And she was to go down and get in the train. But there was a few slip-ups, apart from waiting for weather hours sometimes, doing it over and over again. And when they got the perfect weather, right at the bottom of the steps, there was a urinal facing the steps, gents. And they got a perfect picture, and just as she got down there, there was a chappie came out of the urinal buttoning his trousers. Well, that had to be scrapped. Then they got another fairly good picture with weather, and the guard put her in the coach, the railway coach, and instead of going back to his own brake van then, he got in with her. Well, that spoiled that, so it had to be taken again. Mm. They eventually got it right.
We didn't see George Hogg, the station master, in the film at all.
I don't think he was in it. He was too peeved that they turned his station into an Irish station.
He didn't like that.
Well, I was sent out beforehand to cover up Union Mills. And if you remember, under the wall, as you look over the wall from the road, there's this three legs
man, yes, made in stone.
In spar stone.
Yes.
From the Stony Mountain. And I had to cover that up with artificial grass. And he was such a nice man. He was my next door neighbour, always pleasant. And he blew up this day, and nobody turning my station into a Irish station. And he wouldn't let me work, so I had to ring for the producer to come out and sort things out.
There was some doubt, I think, about whether Deborah Carr was on the arm, but she definitely wasn't.
Oh, Deborah was there, yes. Mm. She was only about 19 or 20 then, lovely girl. Well, then there was a job at Laxey. They wanted two soldiers to get in the tram car with her at Laxey, and they were going to pay £2 to each soldier for to do this. Well, I'd been in the Home Guard and had the military uniform, and I says, well, I'll do that, and I'll bring a mate. But it ended up we weren't allowed to. They had to have soldiers, regulars. They got regular soldiers from headquarters garrison at Marathon.
Which hotel was used on the front, Fred?
They were using the Athol.
And did it last just a few days, or was it weeks?
I was about 2 weeks running around with them, yes. Because there was an awful lot of waste time, you know, waiting for weather. And in the finish, we all reported at the Athol one morning, as usual, 9 o'clock in the morning. And they were all getting in taxis heading for the boat. So I said, what's happening? And Phil in charge said, the weather's too bad, we're going to finish it in Ireland.
Just left like that?
Yes, it was to be in an Irish picture anyway. Mm. And they said, we'll finish it in Ireland. And the paymaster said, we've left money for you people to be, you know, tips, I suppose they meant, for doing the work, but we never got a halfpenny. So that ended that.
And that's ended our time in the archive room this week, because now it's time for me to open the door and return you to the present day. But I do hope you can come back at the same time next week, when I'll be taking you to Cunningham's camp and hearing the story of a remarkable businesswoman whose courage changed a hotel from failing to flourishing. And if you enjoy these programmes, all episodes of the Archive Room are available as podcasts at manxradio.com or via your usual podcast provider. And so, till whenever we meet again, this is Judith saying thank you for listening and...
So long, yourself.